Well met, and welcome to episode 56, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November 7, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to kick off our month-long discussion of Richard II with a few introductory words on the play and the first half of our plot synopsis. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. This month, we're back to the histories and the beginning of the second tetralogy, well, the second one produced. Remember, last year we discussed the first four-play cycle, the three Henry VI and Richard III. Now, those plays dealt with the end of the War of the Roses. This month, we're going to go back to what caused the War of the Roses with the Second Tetralogy, a series of plays including Richard II, the two parts of Henry IV, and Henry V, the end of which brings us, chronologically speaking, back to the beginning of the First Tetralogy and the first part of Henry VI. Got that? Good. So we know Richard II is a history, right? The 1623 First Folio lists the title as The Life and Death of King Richard II. However, while the first quarto's version has the same title, the fifth quarto, in 1615, listed the title as The Tragedy of Richard II, which isn't a horrible title, as Richard does fall from power over the course of the play. The play begins with one of those quiet beginnings. No alarms, but the entrance of the king and old John of Gaunt with assorted other nobles. Now, we'll get to the relationships and history of this history, or tragedy, or historical tragedy, or tragical history, later in the month in the blog, but suffice to say, John of Gaunt is the uncle of the king. The king immediately asks John if he has brought his bold son, who has a suit against the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas Mowbray. Now, John's son, the Duke of Hereford, Henry Bolingbroke, has accused Mowbray of plotting the Duke of Gloucester's death. The Duke of Gloucester, by the way, was another one of the king's uncles. Mowbray admits to having been Gloucester's jailer, but denies having killed him. The implication is that the king had ordered the imprisonment of Gloucester and thus may also be ultimately responsible for the murder. Bolingbroke and Mowbray challenge each other to trial by combat, and Richard attempts to talk them out of it, unsuccessfully, of course. Does that sound at all like our weak King John from a couple of months back? Why, yes. Yes, I think it does. And in a bold and confident statement made in a style reminiscent of that play's The Bastard, Bolingbroke tells the king, "Ere my tongue shall wound my honor with such feeble wrong, or sound so base a parle, my teeth shall tear the slavish motive of recanting fear and spit it, bleeding in his high disgrace where shame doth harbor, even in Mowbray's face." Oh, it's on. And the trial by combat is set. In the second scene of the first act, John of Gaunt meets with the Duchess of Gloucester, the widow of his brother, the murdered prisoner. She attempts to convince John to join Bolingbroke in revenging her husband's death, which she considers murder. While the emotion may be the same as Constance's in King John, her approach is well-reasoned and calm, and one would think it would be convincing. Well, maybe if one was in the 20th or 21st century. In the late 14th century, however, not so much. John of Gaunt states that the king is God's substitute, and thus immune from human punishment or revenge. Only heaven can punish a king. Now, we who know history know where this story is going. So the question is Bolingbroke the arm of such heavenly revenge? Well, the play then jumps to the day of the trial by combat between Bolingbroke and Mowbray. Each combatant enters and states his case. King John tells Bolingbroke that he needs to be right in his accusation because if he isn't, and thus is killed in this just fight, the king will not be able to revenge his death. The fighter is ready, but just before the fight begins, Richard stops it. He delivers his decree. He will not allow our kingdom's earth to be soiled with that dear blood which it hath fostered. Instead, he banishes both men. Bolingbroke must leave England for twice 5 summers, 10 years, Mowbray, on the other hand, has a heavier doom, never to return to England. Not only do they not get a chance to prove their cases, but they're kicked out of their own country. It's enough to make two guys want to, you know, join forces. But Richard has an answer for that, too. "You never shall, so help you truth and God, embrace each other's love in banishment, nor never look upon each other's face, nor never write regreet, nor reconcile this lowering tempest of your homebred hate, nor never by advised purpose meet to plot, contrive, or complot any ill against us, our state, our subjects, or our land. In other words, Richard effectively kills discussion of the death of Gloucester and removes the two people who seemed bent on exposing the truth, or at least had known the truth. After Mowbray leaves and Richard sees John of Gaunt's grieved heart in his eyes, the king reduces the sentence to only 6 years banishment. Now, when John and Bolingbroke and their followers are left on stage by Richard, they discuss what has transpired, and Bolingbroke comes off like a mature version of Romeo. He's upset over his banishment, but he's not on the floor crying. And to this his father advises, "Think not the king did banish thee, but thou the king." Nothing like a little Act One foreshadowing, huh? Okay, well, in the short Act One Scene 4, Richard receives news of Bolingbroke's departure. And in his response, we hear snippets of Richard's real reason to banish Bolingbroke. Fear. The king doesn't like Bolingbroke's ability to dive into the common people's hearts with humble and familiar courtesy. Richard scorns Bolingbroke's craft of smiles, which wins him the love of the commoners, as if Richard's England is, in reversion, actually Bolingbroke's. Now, what was I saying about this first act foreshadowing? But with Bolingbroke gone, the king can focus on the wars in Ireland, for which Richard is enforced to farm our royal realm, taxing the citizens to refill the coffers, which have grown somewhat light. This troubling news is somewhat lightened by the word from Bushy that old John of Gaunt is grievous sick. At least Richard has this working for him, as the lining of John's coffers shall make coats to deck our soldiers for these Irish wars. And thus, Act One ends. At the beginning of Act 2, Scene 1, we find the dying Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt, at Ely House, waiting for the king to arrive so that he can breathe his last counsel to the king's unstayed youth. Richard arrives, and the dying man tells the king, "Thy deathbed is no lesser than thy land, wherein thou liest in reputation sick." Richard is now merely landlord of England, not king. Richard calls him a lunatic, lean-witted fool, one whose tongue that runs so roundly in his head should run his head from his irreverent shoulders. Gaunt, before leaving, says the King Richard will suffer a fate prone to all evil men. "These words hereafter my tormentors be." Yeah, that's type of Shakespearean foreshadowing there, as Shakespeare writes those words himself. Within moments, Lord Northumberland arrives with word that old John of Gaunt is now dead. Now, who is this Northumberland? Henry Percy, father to one Hotspur, but that's next month's play. Richard is dismissive, even saying, "So much for that," when he hears the news of the death, and then announces that he is taking Gaunt's titles and properties. York, Richard's last surviving uncle, cannot take much more. It's bad enough with Gloucester's murder, Bolingbroke's banishment, the prevention of poor Bolingbroke's marriage, but taking away Bolingbroke's rights to his father's lands, titles, and properties is just too much to take. Again, the king is less than sympathetic, saying, "Think what you will. We seize into our hands his plate, his goods, his money, and his lands." And then he leaves the English lords to stew, and they begin to feel sorry, or more than sorry, for Bolingbroke, who, they hear, will shortly return to England. Act 2, Scene 2 finds the queen sad over what she senses is a bad future for her absent Richard, you know, away on the Irish wars, especially since Bolingbroke has now landed in England. York arrives, but he is less sad than ambivalent. He doesn't know whom to support, but he's actually willing to say this in front of the queen. In Act 2, Scene 3, Bolingbroke is met by the support of English lords, including the tender, raw, and young Hotspur, who has joined his father in support of Bolingbroke. Bolingbroke claims to return to England only for the rights to his father's lands. Now, when he greets his uncle York, his uncle reprimands him. It seems that York, over the course of the last scene, has made his decision, and it's to support the current king. And in York's loyal bosom lies Richard's power. He denounces the banished nephew to suddenly appear in his land of exile. But Bolingbroke's argument is a legal one. "As I was banished Hereford. But as I come for Lancaster. Will you permit that I shall stand condemned, a wandering vagabond, my rights and royalties, plucked from my arms perforce and given away to upstart unthrifts?" He's no longer the banished man he was, he claims, but now the heir to his father. He claims not to be here for the throne of England. And this argument seems to have an effect on the once and future ambivalent York. He is now a neuter, neither for the king nor Bolingbroke. In the short Act 2, Scene 4, the Earl of Salisbury and a Welsh captain await the king's return in Wales. But as he has not returned from Ireland to defend his own throne against the invading Bolingbroke, they can only come to one assumption and conclusion. Richard, their king, is dead. Act 3, Scene 1 finds Bolingbroke pronouncing sentence on the king's buddies. Well, they seem a little too close to be mere political advisors, Bushy and Green. And it's not a light sentence. Presently, your souls must part your bodies. And what is their crime? They've given the king bad advice, misled, and completely changed, disfigured clean, a good man. Bolingbroke also intimates something more sexual between Bushy and Green and the king, as Bushy and Green's sinful hours have divorced the queen and Richard, even in their royal bed. And they've also made the queen cry. Bad, Bushy and Green, bad. Now, that eight-line speech started off seemingly righteous, you know, misleading the king, but it falls off from there, becoming salacious and sensationalistic in the remainder of those lines. It gets worse, however, in the 12 lines that follow as we get to see a more personal reason. Bolingbroke is still pissed over his banishment. This makes the execution sound an awful lot like petty revenge, not a positive quality. So on one hand, we have a deceitful king, one willing to snatch away a dead man's titles, and a possible petty usurper. Not a good choice. Of course, Bushy and Green don't have to worry about it. Bolingbroke sends them off with Northumberland, remember, Percy, to their execution, while he plans to fight the Welsh, led by Glendower. Now, we know from the last scene in Act 2 that the Welsh forces were in support of Richard. It now looks like Bolingbroke is ready to fight the king's forces, but must he to regain his titles? Act 3, Scene 2 finds that Richard has returned from Ireland and is in despair. He wants the earth itself to rise up and do annoyance to the treacherous feet which with usurping steps do trample thee. It's obvious he doesn't see Bolingbroke's return as anything but a bold-faced grab for the crown. His lords, including the neutered Duke of York's son, attempt to cheer their king, telling him, "That power that made you king hath power to keep you king in spite of all. God will out," they say. The speeches work, as Richard says that Bolingbroke's treasons will sit blushing in his face, not able to endure the sight of day, but self-affrighted tremble at his sin. However, the cheer is short-lived. When he hears that the Welshmen, hearing Richard were dead, have gone over to Bolingbroke's side, the king momentarily falls into despair again, and thus it goes for the rest of the scene. The lords cheer him. He regains composure. Bad news comes. The king wails, at one point saying, "How can you say to me I am a king?" And so on. Now, when the final piece of bad news comes, the neutral York has joined Bolingbroke. It's the last straw, and Richard discharges his supporters and can foresee the change from Richard's night to Bolingbroke's fair day. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Enter Richard, the woohoo self-congratulatory tangent episode, Begin the Fall, That Ain't No Fight, Roller Coaster of Richard, Now That's a Fight, Not Really Either. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news than the daily discussion of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November 7, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.